Okay. It is now, this is the IBS Oral History Project. Paul Rodell here again. It is now September the 4th, and I'm in the house of Frank and Manning and his wife, Chris. Frank was an IBS volunteer in Laos, 1968 through 1969, not quite a full term of service, ended somewhat short. He was in rural development in a number of different places, worked under Bob Lovin as chief of party and direct, more direct under Art Stillman before his death. Okay, good enough. That's enough for introduction. And for first question, again, mentioned before I turned on the tape, we're getting background material on the profiles of who joined IVS and what they were as far as young Americans. So the first question is when and where you were born, something perhaps about your parents, who they were. Not just names, but who they were in terms of their role in your life and in the community and your family and other influences, whatever they may be, that formed you as a young man, getting you up to the day when you would consider something like service in IBS. And I just let you go on and kibitz and sip my coffee.
Okay. We'll start at the beginning. I was born in April of 1945 in Detroit, Michigan, to Frank and Helen Manning. I was the fifth of six children, four older sisters and a younger brother. Came about 4 years after me. Father's a railroad engineer. He was second generation railroad engineer after his father. Yeah, graduate. Civil engineering from Michigan Agricultural College around 1928. Got married just in the height of the Depression, 1931. Went to work for the railroad because Fisher Body closed the plant down and the stuff, the 12-cylinder engine he was designing on, the whole group was laid off because of the Depression.
He stuck with a 12-cylinder?
Yeah.
Wow, talk about gas guzzler.
Yeah. Yeah, they came in and laid the whole 400 off. Apparently just a few weeks before he was to be married over in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a nurse. Went through St. Joseph's in La Crosse, Wisconsin. A three-year program and was working in the Detroit area where they met.
Uh-huh.
They originally lived in Grand Rapids and moved back down to Detroit as the railroad moved them around somewhat. Raised in a Catholic ghetto after World War II with all of the post-war baby boom kids. I was just ahead of the, not being a boomer since I was born in 45, I'm a step ahead of them.
Well, yeah.
Officially. But big, happy, like I say, a Catholic ghetto. There's like 4,000 families in the parish, so even though the neighborhood probably was fairly well interspersed with Protestant things like that, it was a pretty much a white bread experience.
Mm-hmm.
Minorities had moved out to that part of the city at that time. My school was mostly Irish and Polish, and that was the big ethnic rivalry then. Brought up, to say, in the Catholic tradition, 12 years of nuns. Then I went off to Notre Dame. In some ways, it was like the 13th year of high school. Some of the priests were very dogmatic and very wrapped up in the old this is it sort of tradition. I always had a streak of, I guess you'd say, altruism and service to my fellow man and things like that. And some ways I probably, if I retained a strong faith, going to Notre Dame is probably one of the reasons I lost it. Would have been off to the to the missionary priesthood or something like that.
Oh no, I think Chris and I are both enjoying your
your it's an oral history, all right.
Yeah. No, I just, I've known some other Notre Damers, the same thing happened to.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have been in engineering. My dad was an engineer. His father before him had been a self-taught engineer, not a degree engineer. And as part of my upbringing, the feeling was, well, you did something significant, something to help the world, and I couldn't see just getting a, you know, teaching or something like that, that never attracted me. So engineering was something I wanted to use as a tool to help the world. And unfortunately, I wasn't that good an engineering student. But with the constraints of the draft, things like that, I had too much time invested in it. I muddled through, got my degree, bringing up the bottom of the class.
What year was that?
That was 68.
Oh, okay. All right. In June, then, of 68?
No, in February. I got a bonus semester. I should have graduated in 67.
67, yeah.
But to bring my grade point up, I had to make up some classes. I had to stay an extra semester.
We did the same. We both did that. Because I should have graduated June of 67.
Yeah. So
Then I switched majors. And to do that, I had to take a bunch of courses.
No, I didn't switch majors. I toughed it out and stayed in engineering. And a place like Notre Dame with 6,400 undergraduate, there isn't the big classic chunks are your choices, you know, business or English or, you know, liberal arts or stuff like that. And like I say, I, in one sense, felt that it was...
Yes. But that's when...
Let's see. God has a plan, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and an interesting...
And just in case that didn't come on the tape, Chris looked around the corner and said, but he did meet me.
In my bonus semester, I met her.
In the bonus semester?
I hadn't stuck around the extra semester.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah, all right. I see. Okay. I didn't catch that.
So anyways, with my grade point there, graduate school was out of the question. Dad really didn't have the money for it, and I didn't, of course, have any money saved.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that as soon as I did get a degree, I'd be prime cannon fodder, so I, among other things, wrote a letter to the State Department and said, how about some of those high-paying jobs you've got overseas? And they wrote back and said, well, you need 5 years' experience before you get one of those, but they are actually the ones who sent me the brochure on IBS.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. And I had, so I corresponded with them, and I also was talking with the Peace Corps. Now, the Peace Corps didn't give you a job deferment. And,
well, that was up to the local board.
Yeah, but you might get one, but not automatically. IBS got you a 2A deferment.
Mm-hmm.
Before I left, I had a 2A deferment, which is,
okay.
One of the things I had to have was some security there that I wouldn't be pulled back from overseas or something like that. But the Peace Corps took a long time, and it was literally just about the end of January when I was graduating when I finally heard from them. They wanted me to go to work on irrigation in the Helmand Valley in Afghanistan, and by then I'd already, a month earlier, accepted the position with IBS. Again, at Notre Dame, I doubt that, you know, it's possible, but I doubt that there's been any other IVSers from Notre Dame. When I had my interview, I went over to Goshen College, which is just east of there, and Goshen, probably on a per capita basis, had 1,000 times the presence that a big place like Notre Dame would have. But there were a lot of those Mennonite and Brethren colleges in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Earlham earlier, and I think there's a few others around that a lot of these guys came from.
But, you know, you said that you always had this desire to, you know, use your engineering to do something good. and some interest in overseas.
Yeah.
How did that develop, the interest in the overseas work? What do you think was the cause of that?
I just always wanted to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And then be different places. I never was that interested in going to Europe, though I have gone to England a few years ago, and
uh-huh.
there's other places I'd like to go, but I'm just as happy going off to Asia and
mm-hmm.
places like that. We went to Australia a few years ago, too, and that was
quite
a trip.
No, I was wondering if maybe you might have known some foreign students when you were an undergrad, or some travel documentaries, or maybe had some missionaries come back from some part of the world and talk to
your
church. Well,
we always had missionaries talking, and then...
I'm just wondering, you know, what caused this interest?
Well, most Americans, I think, generally tend to be xenophiles. We, like, love China, and even though we don't know anything about it, and
uh-huh.
that was part of it. And, you know, hearing about the Maryknoll missionaries, possibly, might
okay.
have been it, but I can't remember any specific events like that. It just... The idea was that to help people, and overseas was the place to help.
Yeah, yeah.
And, the adventure and stuff like that.
And you saw the help mostly through your father and your grandfather, who had used their engineering to make things that lasted beyond them?
Yeah, that's really his part of it, you know, making a change, not, you know, and not to belittle people, but I mean... The one thing I liked about IVS is they had a lot of technical people. They
uh-huh.
they recruited
okay.
people that had a skill that could be used to build on. And I know a lot of the ex-Peace Corps people that I met in IVS liked that, because if they needed materials for a project, they were able to get it through the USAID connection, whereas a lot of times their Peace Corps assignments, there was no money for building things. It was, you know,
no, we weren't supposed to have any money
yeah.
for that. Because the Peace Corps idea was to keep us so resource-less that people wouldn't just be doing community development projects just because they could get a pile of goodies. But
yeah.
then, of course, how can you do a development project without some materials? I had problems with that as a volunteer
yeah.
in Peace Corps. I mean, I know this is your interview, not mine, but... Okay, so but the contrast is there, and you are choosing between the two organizations. Even though you do give your commitment to IVS first, you had been looking at
Peace Corps.
Well, I had
just,
had
you know, trying things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, when I was a sophomore and extremely frustrated with my studies, I even talked to the Marine Corps, but I didn't
mm-hmm.
see dropping out and going to the Marines at that time.
Okay.
I mean, Notre Dame, it seems like a kind of a liberal place, and that's only in the context of the Catholic Church. It's actually fairly conservative, and the vast
mm-hmm.
majority of people that went to Southeast Asia from Notre Dame went with a gun in the hand or were flying a jet or something
yeah.
like that. There's an awful lot of them went over there and did their service
mm-hmm.
because that was the thing to do when we were fighting those godless communists and stuff like that. And I was a little more ambivalent about that. I didn't buy that whole story. And I had a choice between Vietnam or Laos initially, and I chose Laos because I figured, well, I can get a feel for what's going on with not being quite in the middle of the action.
Yeah.
And then as it turned out, with the Tet Offensive, there wasn't anybody sent to Vietnam anyways. And my, you know, my choice would have been go to Laos or not go at all. So
mm-hmm.
I would have been there anyways.
Of course, little did you know that there was enough action going around in Laos, too.
Well, it was a different sort of action. I had never
mm-hmm.
felt that I was personally threatened or in danger. I was evacuated a few times and told not to go a few places, and of course we stayed off the roads at night in most rural areas, stuff like that. My interpreter was killed by a grenade, but you know, just luck that I wasn't with him. I think if it had happened 15 minutes later, I'd probably been sitting at the same table with him and might have bought it at the same time.
What was the circumstance there?
At a festival in Takyak when I was down there. And,
uh-huh.
It's a big social event, and you know, was an evening, and there was all kinds of tents and things like that. And
I remember now. Ken Steiner said to ask you about the death of this guy.
Yeah, Prasut Pongsila. And I was that evening. I remember went over and saw John Williams, who was an ex. He'd been Peace Corps Thailand for at least a couple terms, and then he was working for USAID in Laos, and working in the kind of a economic co-op type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And we were pretty good buddies, and so I'd stopped by, and we were on our way over, and it was, you know, fairly early, probably 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and we'd just gotten there, and it's a big, huge area with all kinds of booths and tables all over the place, and we're just kind of making our way across them, and this huge boom.
Yeah.
And of course we went back to John's right then, not knowing what was going on, and there was a few people staggering around with some wounds and stuff like that, but you know, the standard practice of something like that is, you know, don't stay out and be a target if you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We didn't have any military training or anything like that, but in the turmoil, we, you know.
But you've got common sense.
Yeah, common sense. We just kind of hightailed it. So it really wasn't until later found out that, essentially the story as I heard it was that he was sitting at a table with a group of people, and a disgruntled Lao soldier was pissed off at his commanding officer and threw a grenade in amongst them. And
just for the hell of it.
Well, he was pissed, and he was... And... maybe
you mean the commanding officer was sitting there, too?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, they call him Vietnam fragging.
Yeah.
So he was...
He's fragging his officer.
He fragged his officer and took out, I think, about a dozen people at the time. And so we... put, you know, they wrapped him in a body bag, and his friends got, you know, plywood together, and they built a wooden coffin and covered it with black paper and cut out gold and glued it on. It was, you know, a homemade sort of thing. This was, I think, the boat festival in October is when that was. And I think it was the officer or some other high official had been killed, and there were some planes coming up from Vientiane bringing a bunch of relatives and other big shots to come down there for the funeral. And we were able to... on one of the return flights, get the casket on there.
Uh-huh.
It turns out Prasut was actually from northern Thailand, which ethnically the northern Thai and the Lao are both considered country bumpkins by the
uh-huh.
central Thai people down in Bangkok. So his dad came up. Again, the festival was going on down in Vientiane too, and so they didn't really want to have him like sitting in state as you would at a funeral home here. We ended up putting him in a big refrigerator unit they had for storing grain that the ag department had.
Uh-huh.
So we got him kept him chilled down for a couple days. So it was a few days before we could get him out and get him into the Wat, the temple, to put
yeah.
him on the pyre and then have the cremation.
Yeah.
And as his dad came up from Thailand there, I'll get a picture of the two of us with a picture of Prasut, and I'll get a couple pictures of the thing. At about the same time, Alex McIntosh's boat driver was ambushed and killed too.
Hmm.
And they had him brought down and was in Vientiane about the same time and had a bigger party for him. I guess one of, this is all anecdotal, I don't know for sure, but I mean, this is the story I heard at the time, was that one of the deceased cousins was a pimp, and he had all his girls working the party, which is more like a wake, and then that they didn't just all sit around crying. There was a lot of good times being had, too.
Mm.
So they were both cremated about the same time.
But this fellow was working for McIntosh.
Yeah, he was like a boat driver. He was up country where he had to take a boat in
uh-huh.
to where he was, so you couldn't even drive in.
McIntosh was.
Yeah.
McIntosh. So this was kind of like
one of his servants, and if they'd gone ahead and shot Alex or Court, then they'd have brought the wrath of God and the Lao army down on him.
Uh-huh.
But they shoot one of his employees,
uh-huh.
and they put the message out, you know, don't work for these guys, you know, bad Americans. But,
right, right.
So, but, cause,
so that wasn't necessarily a threat against McIntosh himself.
Well, they were
kind of scaring off the
help.
They
were scaring off the help because if they, you know, they killed an American, they brought too much attention to themselves.
Right, yeah. No, it just seems to make a lot of rational sense. Because as soon as they're gone, he's, you know, what can he do? You know.
So, yeah, that's what I'm impressed with. And one thing that had been happening, I had been, well, well, let's go back and replay the tape into getting to Laos. We're kind of jumping ahead in the story.
We are jumping ahead, and I allowed that to go on because you were
on
a roll.
I was on a roll.
And it's sometimes better to do that.
Yeah.
You know. But when this story was done, I was going to say, well, yeah. Let's get back to kind of a chronological
development.
But, you know, sometimes if someone says something good, you know,
sure.
That's fine. But getting back to the chronology.
Well, in December of 67, I was back in, we lived in Huntington, West Virginia at the time, and that's the first time.
Really?
That
I lived near there once.
That it, yeah, my, the railroad had moved my dad down there.
Uh-huh.
And I, just after I finished high school, so I never lived there except a few summers. That's, I came home for Christmas and told my folks that I was going to go over to Laos and, that's about the time that article was in Time magazine about Gettleson being killed in the Mekong Delta, and of course they made it seem like it was Viet Cong, and it turned out to be later that it was more than likely Vietnamese that did him in because he was going to blab everything to Senator Kennedy's refugee committee that was going to meet over there.
Yeah, at district officers.
So, yeah, apparently one of the more pacified areas of Vietnam at the time, and all of a sudden he gets killed. So.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty fishy. So,
very, very fishy, yeah.
So I went back, finished up in January, and then I say it was just about the time of the Tet Offensive, early February, that we all flew off to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first got to Washington, there was, I think, about three or four IBSers that were missing from the Tet Offensive. A couple
yeah.
guys and a couple gals. The gals were released.
Well, I was thinking it was only one woman.
Well.
Nancy Johnson.
Whatever the number.
Yeah.
My recollection is she was released within a few months. I don't remember. It was too long a time period. But
yeah.
The guys came out in 73, I think, when the MIAs came out. And, of course, their $80 a month have been piling up in the bank, I'm sure, for them the whole time.
The big money.
The big money, yeah.
Yeah.
We had a French-speaking, I think he was French... volunteer who was actually went down to Cambodia, I believe, trying to put some feelers out, finding out what happened to these. I think that some of the ones that were captured were Canadian, it seems to me.
A fellow named Marc Caillé, who has written his memoirs in Peace IVS has translated it, and you can write off for a copy.
Yeah, I seem to remember meeting him way back then. But we all went to Washington, like I said, must have been about the middle of February. It was well after Tet was over, but a lot of things were still up in the air. I think it was the last 2 weeks, pretty much, of February. There was, let's say, four of us for rural development and two going in education, so there was a whole six of us spent a couple weeks Don Bowman and Al Best are the educators, and then John Bryson, Dennis Mummer, and Dave Hendricks, and myself.
Uh-huh.
And we had an interesting time. I met Larry Olson, somewhat incognito. I think he was on the land even then from the draft board. He'd come back from Laos.
And on the land? Because he was afraid that if He told the draft board where he was, that they would.
Oh yeah, he was. Immediately. He was a wanted man by then. I think he was. He had refused to go.
Oh yeah, actually wasn't gone wasn't, to wasn't the refusal.
Gonna,
yeah.
He wasn't gonna do the CO thing. No. CO had never been a real option to me. I mean, as a devout Catholic, we had, you know, the concept of a just war and things like that. So conscientious objection always probably happened more than they talked about. Mm-hmm. Wasn't really an option for most Catholics. You get laughed if you come and say something like that. And they're always patriotic fighters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't, I mean, I had a certain amount of altruism. I wanted to help people. It wasn't as much an anti-war type of thing as it was just, you know, wanted to help people, was unsure which way this whole thing was going over there. But, I mean,
mm-hmm.
naively thought, yeah, well, we must be doing the right thing. But then I was still at the time when I believed that, you know, we had won every war we'd fought in. We'd always done it for the right reasons and things like that. And,
yeah.
So that was part of the 50s and my upbringing.
Were there a lot of anti-war protests at Notre Dame at that time? I know that it wasn't universal.
As I've said in the past, the biggest disturbance I can remember from my senior year is when they said they were going to have female cheerleaders from St. Mary's College, and the demonstrations were led by Jim Lynch, a classmate of mine who was captain of the football team, protesting uh-huh. this terrible thing. There were some fasting in very non-demonstrative, very peaceful, low-key type things going on.
Uh-huh.
That,
so Notre Dame
big hemming.
Notre Dame was still...
There were some going on. When I was a freshman, George Wallace was up during the Indiana presidential primary, and there was a lot of, picketing about that. He spoke on campus, as I remember, and
mm-hmm.
some of the big black football players went and sat in the first row and stuff like that. And there was a lot of signs.
Very good.
But as I remember, there was a lot of signs, but they were all printed, and, you know, it was...
Uh-huh.
Fairly standard
kind of sedate
way to release your, well, there was third pounding on the car and stuff like that, but it wasn't too wild. This is the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, like I say, there were some prayer vigils and things like that. People okay. would stand and you know, silent protest, but it was not a big thing. You know, mm-hmm. It was not necessarily in the Notre Dame tradition and stuff like that. Most of my classmates that didn't serve in the Guard or get out of it some other way. A lot of them went on to grad school and
mm-hmm.
missed it. Would you know, they'd be in the service. They'd be flying the planes or stuff like that.
Yeah, you said that, but I was wondering if there was, you know, at least a subculture.
Well, there may have been more than I appreciated. I don't know.
Well, but the thing is, you're also recalling what formed you, and obviously that yeah. was not part of it. It wasn't, for example, you mentioned David Hendricks as one of the people in the group. He had already been in trouble with the law for some of his protesting activities.
Yeah.
And I've talked to other people, for example, who served in Laos, Deander Wilson, who mentioned that he was already well involved in SDS before he went into Laos.
But yeah. there was an awful lot of people, I think, in Laos that were there to serve and came from a nonviolent tradition like the Mennonites and the Brethren. That,
oh, yeah, yeah. Not to deny that.
That weren't necessarily against American policy and stuff like that. They felt they were doing it their way. And a lot of them were doing CO work, too.
Sure, sure.
But it was so that they didn't like or approve, I'm sure, the methods of the war that was going on, but it wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily that they were, you know, wild left-wing liberals and stuff like
no,
that.
No.
And at the time, I don't think I was, but I was, you know, I've always gone my own way, I guess, in some mm-hmm. things, and made up my own mind, and that's gotten me, that's a trouble of interesting circumstances.
Yeah. Well, no, I just wanted to just see where you were in relation to some of the other people and the times, and that's been. Yeah, over dinner you mentioned that your parents saw this article about Gettleson. And
well, that was the first time that either they or I had ever seen really anything in print about IBS. It was their first introduction to it, as a guy was killed in Vietnam. And that didn't make my mom too happy to hear that. And about the same time, there was an IBSer killed in Laos, too. I forget his name now. I used to know that, I mean, but it was before I got over there.
Well, there were a couple, Scheidler and Chandler Edwards.
Chandler Edwards was when I was still there.
Was when you were still there.
Scheidler might have been the one I'm thinking of. I mean, he was before I left. And Chandler Edwards was killed before I left. Stillman and Mummer died after I left. We'll get into that later, but there was some interesting experiences there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we went to Washington, and they did a lot of things, which, as an engineering student, you know, we never got into role-playing and things like that, so there was some interesting
I'm never into role-playing myself.